Good afternoon, everyone. This is Chris Flanagan here from the Ops Desk. Today we have a very special guest. Joining us is Commissioner Bill Bratton. As many of you know, Commissioner Bratton has one of the premier policing careers in the United States. He was head of several police departments in Boston. He was head of New York City Transit Police Department, head of the NYPD, did a long stint as the chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, and then came back to New York again. Commissioner Bratton, also an established author. He's written three books, Turnaround, Collaborator Perish, and his most recent book is The Profession. These are all must-reads for anyone in law enforcement. So welcome, Commissioner. Very gracious of you to join us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
So we're going to get into some issues around law enforcement that are affecting us all today. So law enforcement has really been up against it over the last few years, really accelerated since the George Floyd issue, but it's been going on for a few years before that as well. It seems like some legitimate reform ideas have just spiraled out of control, and they've gotten to a point where they're hurting us all. How would you say we get back to some common sense but fair policies in government and policing?
We can get back to that path, but it will not be easy. Unfortunately, the momentum is still on the focus on police reform that's largely being led by a very liberal, progressive movement that does not take into account or perspective the gains that American policing has been making in reforming itself over the last, I've been involved with policing now for 50 years, over 50 years. And where we are now is so much further along than where we were in 1970 when I first joined policing. But we're always going to be reforming. We're never going to arrive at a final destination because policing, like every other profession, is constantly evolving. And we are in a period of revolution in that evolutionary trail at the moment. And I've gone through a number of revolutions during my time. In the 1970s, there was the professionalization of American policing that was so profound. It was nothing short of a revolution, the idea that police needed to be better trained and that they needed more technology and that they did need to be held much more accountable than they were in previous years. Another big revolutionary period was the early 1990s with the embrace of the community policing philosophy and its emphasis on partnership, problem solving, and prevention. Next revolution would be the 21st century, coming into the era of terrorism with 9/11. That totally changed American policing and has shaped it significantly for these last 20 odd years. And then we have been in a continuing revolutionary, evolutionary period, really since 9/11, that's in the area of technology, in the world of cyber, that and now moving into the world of artificial intelligence. So the evolutionary path we're on, the revolutions, things that are so significant in changing the profession, are accelerating at a rapid pace. And just the 21st century, what's been going on in the 21st century, defund the police, that is an example of it. It's what keeps the profession so interesting and so challenging.
It is so interesting. I did most of my career in the Detective Bureau. And, you know, when I first got to the Bureau, we were typing on typewriters. And now we're able to do that precision policing effectively. It's really a remarkable pace of change. But I just wanted to get back to some of that, some of those progressive issues. I kind of feel like progressives have like hijacked the Democratic Party in many ways. Democratic Party, first of all, just call them progressives, I think is a bit of a misnomer. I think Teddy Roosevelt would be rolling over in his grave to be associated with some of the people out there. But the Democratic Party was always the party of the working class, and I feel it's morphed into something else, and they're pushing some ideas that are destructive in many ways. Do you share that opinion? And how do we get a voice back?
A comment about that. I've described myself until recent years and the American police profession, and particularly American police leadership, is very progressive. Progressive in the sense that we're embracing change, understanding the need for it, and not resisting a lot of the changes that were felt to be needed. I don't use the term to describe myself that way any longer, because it has been hijacked by the forces of the left, if you will. There's a term that's out there that's bandied about quite frequently, the woke idea. And so I now would describe myself more as a centrist. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I vote independent. I vote the individual. I vote the issue. And as many concerns as I have about the Democrats, particularly the far left component of that, the George Soros, Open Society, district attorneys around the country, I have similar concerns with the Republican Party in the sense of their support and embrace of January 6th. And they frequently describe themselves as the law and order party. To be very frank with you, I don't see much that the Republicans have done for law and order, and at least in the last couple of years have really helped to basically, coupled with what's going on the Democratic far left, the Republican far right, they're making a mess of America at the moment. And putting police really dead center in the middle of the messes that they're creating. And the challenge for American policing going forward is to stay centrist, that we can't be seen to be leaning in one direction or another, that it is the idea of, you know, in terms of we are in a position to uphold the law, whatever those laws are, as long as those laws are constitutionally created.
Yeah, certainly true. It seems like radicals have an outside voice on both sides in today's day and age. And it's unfortunate. One of the issues you speak about in the profession is the race issue within policing. And I think anyone would acknowledge some very serious and in many ways systemic misconduct on the behalf of police departments in the past. I think it's improved dramatically, and there's always more work to do, as you said, in policing in general. But what would you say? I feel like the race issue and acknowledging and that as a big policing issue is being used as like a cudgel against police officers and police departments today. Would you share that opinion or disagree?
Well, there's no denying, as I write in the book, Professional Memoir, that race has been an integral part of the evolution of American policing since I'd go back to Democratic policing. Basically, was born in England, 1829, Sir Robert Peel, Metropolitan Police. And in the 1800s, policing, police departments, agencies, uniformed officers really developed in the 1800s. But always at the center of what police were expected to deal with were race issues, race tensions, race laws, whether it was, you know, the idea of the 40s and 50s, 1800s, 40s and 50s, the idea of the police being required to engage in catching slaves that had escaped, moving forward into the after the Civil War for the next 100 years, particularly down south, the Jim Crow laws that police were very heavily engaged in enforcing that had been found to be very, very racially discriminatory. No, you cannot separate policing from race. That's the reality of it. That's the challenge of it. And it's been even more evident, ironically, in the last several years. The murder of George Floyd was sort of a catalyst for even more attention and focus on the need to try and find a better way going forward. But we have been going forward, and that's what my frustration is, that policing many major cities now, reflecting their populations, are minority majority police forces. New York City Police, Los Angeles Police Force, I think possibly Chicago, but many major departments around the country, and indeed in smaller departments where populations are changing. So police are going to be in the middle of helping to resolve the race issue. We can exacerbate it, or we can help to placate it. And the challenge is to try to do more to address it in a positive way so that the anger and frustrations that have been built up over the last several hundred years are dissipated. And it's going to be challenging. It's not easy. And the problem that we're experiencing at the moment, a lot of that centers around the desire for racial equity, as they would talk about it in terms of a lot of the criminal justice reform initiatives that have been undertaken. And the idea that it was felt that particularly in the 80s and 90s, that the particularly the black population, but minority populations in general, particularly the black populations, were basically over-policed and were over-incarcerated, and particularly around drug violations. And I think we've come to clearly understand that the disparity between powder cocaine and crack cocaine sentencing and possession, as well as sales, was very significantly negatively impactful toward minorities, and we've begun to address that. But my perspective on it is that understanding the disparities and some of the injustices that were in practice in the 80s and 90s, 1980s, 1990s, that we recognize that now. And as we're going forward, we can't use that as an excuse to not deal with effectively those who are committing criminal violations in 2023. This idea that they're going to get a get out of jail free card because of racial disparities and racial inappropriateness in the enforcement law 30, 40 years ago. And that is the frustration at the moment that, and I think it will correct over time, the idea that we will recognize that we cannot continue on the path that we're on, where we're increasingly not allowing police to enforce what laws exist, and increasingly taking away laws that are so necessary to maintain safety on our streets and our subways and our parks. America, I think, is going forward into what will be an awakening similar to what happened in the late 80s and early 90s, that when America, 1990, worst crime year ever in the history of the country, most disorder around America. And that's where community policing was created. And then the crime bill of 1994 that I helped to participate in passing that legislation, 100,000 more cops, assault weapons ban for 10 years. We won back America. Cities like New York, which you and I are certainly familiar with, reduced crime by almost 80%, murders by 90%. America reduced violent crime by 40%. But then into the 21st century, we lost our way once again. But I think we're beginning to recognize, as we did back in the early 90s, you need to do two things. You need to deal more effectively with serious crime. You also have to deal much more effectively with quality of life or minor crime. And I think where we're losing the battle significantly is this increasing tolerance of deviancy. We're defining continually, see, deviancy down, the things that we are tolerating, illegal peddling, all these crazy characters running around every which way on their mopeds and electric bikes, even marijuana sales. The fact that there were 4,000 illegal stores in New York City alone selling marijuana.
Yep, it really is incredible. And each, you know, there's a few near where I'm at right now. I guess they're everywhere, but they're almost like its own little ecosystem of quality of life crimes right in front of the place, like every time. This guy's on the mopeds, this guy's drinking, this guy's smoking. Exactly. You know, it's just a mess in front of every one of them. And there's been some shootings too, because there's money there.
No, we've read this book before. We've seen this play before.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I thought, you know, I always thought crime could go back up, but I didn't think it would be in this way. I thought maybe a new drug or something similar, but it's like we're just shooting ourselves in the foot. And one of the issues around that is that the closing of, or the proposed closing of Rikers, you know, it just seems like we're just following one bad idea up with another, you know?
Let me speak to that, because I've been an outspoken critic of that, the idea of close Rikers, and they're going to build four high-rise jails in four of the boroughs. I'm not doing one in Staten Island. But Rikers They could have closed half of Rikers because the teal population was 22,000 in the midst of the 1990s as we were beginning to control behavior. Arrests went up, and what happened is arrests went up, teal population up for a while, but we began to control behavior to such an extent we changed it with the understanding that once we got it under control, that teal population would go down dramatically. And the proof is the fact that Rikers teal population pre-COVID was down to about 8,000 or 9,000. I think it's around 6,000 or 7,000 right now.
Yes.
You could have closed half of Rikers Island, torn it down, and built a modern prison campus out there with academic centers, workshops, all types of state-of-the-art drug rehabilitation centers for nowhere near the money they're going to spend. They're talking anywhere from $8 to $12 billion to build these new jails. And these new jails, when they're done, you know what the capacity is going to be? 3,000. In a city of 8.5 million people with increasing disorder and crime levels that are still way above where they were back in 2018, the safest year in the history of New York City, we're not going to have any place to put these characters, because one of the things that is going to have to happen as crime continues at fairly high levels, as disorder continues to increase, because we're not allowed to prevent it, that there's going to be more people that need to go to jail. And the excuse not to put them in jail will be, we don't have any space. So in some respects, we're creating a nightmare for ourselves. And the Rikers issue is a clear example of that, that this idea of, well, we want them to be closer to home so they can be closer to their families. Well, 1,000 of the people at Rikers are there for murder. Another 800 are there for attempted murder. Another significant percentage are there for domestic violence. So this idea of keeping them close to their family, you want those 1,800 murderers and attempted murderers and the thousands that are there for domestic violence to remain in the neighborhood close to their loved ones. So that argument doesn't hold any water with me, that the idea that we want so they can have better family visitation rights, et cetera. Who are the victims of most of these characters on Rikers? Family members, neighborhood neighbors, residents? But so much of this crime is committed in their own neighborhoods, and we're going to put them right back into those neighborhoods, particularly now where we don't put them into jail free trial. We just let them run around till the trials come up a year or two after they're first arrested.
Yeah, I attended John Jay under the NYPD Executive Leadership Masters, which I believe you started, and it was very eye-opening. But one of the guest speakers in one of our classes was an architect of the, you know, shut down Rikers, and you know, he gave his spiel, and we asked questions at the end, and you know, obviously one of the questions is, what are we going to do if crime goes back up? And it's, you know, just no answer. And like, I don't understand how you could propose something and not have an answer to such a basic question like that.
Well, the irony on this is that on all sides, most are well-intended in terms of what they're trying to accomplish, whether it's racial equity, whether it's reduced crime and disorder with the minimum amount of police interference. We're all well-intended, but unfortunately, particularly in this city, in this state, the well-intended efforts of legislature, city council, are resulting in what should not be unintended consequences, but anticipated consequences that I know myself, I've been one of those predicting that many of these laws they're passing raise the age, for example, you know, to age 18, to keep them in family court if they're under 18. The amount of violence being committed by young people, not just in this city and state, but around the country, that Chicago, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., phenomenal rise in crime among juveniles.
Why? That's who does the shootings, yeah.
Yeah, because their behavior is not being corrected. They're going into family courts, and it's it is so frustrating. And for me in particular, I don't know, basically it's a personal issue. I spent my whole career dedicated to the idea that police cops count, police matter, and that our actions, basically, if implemented appropriately, could have a profound impact on the quality of life in our city, in our state, in our country. And I was proven right in the 1990s that we got this city the safest it's ever been for 25 years. I used to predict all the time, going around the country giving speeches, you were never going to see crime go up in New York City again. I did not take into account a progressive woke legislature and city council made up of characters who were well-intended in terms of trying to get racial equity, because the vast majority of the crime in the city is committed by minorities, but it's committed against other minorities. So in terms of bending over backwards to help the criminal perpetrators, the defendants, who are they actually harming? They're harming the rest of the population who actually, ironically, voted them into office. As much as I point the finger at politicians, the ultimate finger has to be pointed at the voters who put them into office. And Ed Koch had a very famous saying. I quote it all the time because I think it's so appropriate, particularly watching what's going on in Washington, D.C. these last couple of days, that after he lost his last election against Dave Dinkins back in 1989, he was asked about losing the election. He said, well, the voters have spoken. Now they must be punished. And the reality of it, Dave Dinkins, who was a good friend and I worked under his administration, as much as he tried, he got crime down a couple of percentage points, but nobody really felt it. The extent that Giuliani was able to take advantage of that in 93 because of particularly the disorder on the streets that still wasn't being addressed, and won the election on doing something about crime. And he was able to do something about crime. And so Ed Koch had it right that what's the old expression? You get what you pay for, or you get what you vote for. And with all the lunatic antics going on down in Washington, in the nation's capital, we have basically, they call it a clown show now. We have voted a lot of clowns into office and around the country. And in New York, unfortunately, we seem to have more than our fair share.
Yeah, the quality of our political leadership is nothing short of disturbing these days.
Talk about defining expertise, skill, and down. Well, we've got clear examples of that here in New York.
Yeah, one of the things that's really driving the chaos and the fear to the public on the street is mental illness. The NYPD is fighting the fight and clawing back some of those increases in the crime rate. I think shootings are down 27% and homicides are down 11% for the year, still higher than they were prior to 2020. But they're clawing them back. But disorder and is still out there in the street. A lot of that involves the mentally ill. It's a significant problem when you walk down the block. How do we address that issue in a better way? Like, should the police be stepping back from that, or do we need more resources?
The irony is, we know how to do it, but if you just raise more resources, it's going to take a hell of a lot more resources than we're willing to commit. And I would predict then we will commit. I describe our current crises as shaped by four influences. Homelessness, which began, interestingly enough, in the 1970s when we emptied out the mental institutions that were horrific places. And we put about 500,000 people supposedly going back into neighborhood treatment centers, treatment at home with family. And where did most of them end up? On the street. So we created the beginning of the homeless crises in the 70s by putting onto our streets, even as we were reducing the number of police on our streets, people who could not care for themselves and whose erratic behavior oftentimes ended up in creating fear or violence against others. We also have the issue, so you got homeless, you got the mentally ill and the many degrees of mental illness, and then you got the narcotics problem. With the in which we're going through right now, 100,000 plus deaths around fentanyl, echoing the crack epidemic of the 1980s and probably worse. So you get the influence of drugs. You also have the fourth influence of violence that has become so much more commonplace. Why? Because there's so many more damn guns in the country. When I was a young cop, going back to the days when you came on, I came in 1970. If we got a 5-shot revolver, that was a significant gun recovery. We were still dealing with zip guns, homemade guns. Now they make them at home, but they're ghost guns. They're every bit as deadly and as dangerous as the guns being made by manufacturers. So we have all these multiple crises. And what did we do with the mentally ill that who are on the streets committing crime? Many of them we leave out on the streets, but 40% of the population of bikers is determined to be significantly mentally ill. So we took them out of one form of incarceration, mental institutions, and put them into another form of incarceration, our jails and prisons. which was far worse for them because then they are brutalized and terrorized by the other prisoners in those facilities, where they get almost no care for the mental issues that they're fighting.
Yeah, agreed. You're not helping those people at all. And yeah, Rikers is probably not the right place for most of them. Yeah, you make a good point with the guns. I say this all the time. Like, I remember, you know, when I came on, you might have a gun collar and you'd have it like taped together, or the handle would be half broken off. And now you're seeing perps with, like, I see the recoveries on like social media, and they're getting some real, not like high-end firearms, like $1,000 guns. And, you know, I see things through a financial crimes lens, and I feel like, you know, financial crimes is a big part of the gangs in the city. And I think they're able to afford getting some of those firearms today.
As you may recall, that one of the reasons why I fought successfully to get 9mm Glocks at transit police officers in New York in 1990 was because of the proliferation of higher powered weapons in the hands of criminals in the 1980s, where our cops were still running around with 6-shot Smith & Wesson revolvers, and the criminals were running around with Zigs and Glocks. And the cops were literally outgunned. And then a year or two later, they authorized them for NYPD officers, although they only authorized a 10-round clip instead of the 17-round clip. Then I corrected that when I became commissioner in 1994. But no, you can't underestimate the guns, 400 million of them supposedly in the country now, more guns than people. And so you link all these elements. Can it be corrected? It can, because we reduced murders, violent crime so dramatically in this city in the 1990s, as we had the law, laws to work with. We had a criminal justice system where district attorneys worked with the police, worked with the courts, worked with corrections, worked with probation and parole. None of us are working together any longer. Parole's a joke. The parole board, it's a disgrace in the sense of the people they're letting out, particularly all the cop killers. But parole doesn't mean anything anymore. That somebody on parole commits another crime, they don't go back to jail anymore. Basically, they let go again. It's the issue. There is no punishment for minor crime or more serious crime, or not appropriate levels of punishment. And I see no near-term changes in that. And until we get changes in that, we're not going to see a dramatic decrease in crime. And it's for the mentally ill that, once again, the burden of that falls on the police, because there is not enough money to have specially trained people who deal with the mentally ill respond to every mentally ill call. Not in a city like New York, where there's 1,000 of those calls a day, and that who still goes to the police. And during my time as police commissioner, we had a 4-day course to try and give every cop in the street a better understanding of the mentally ill. But in 4 days, we can't treat what it takes a doctor 4 to 6 years to learn about all the different psychiatric problems that people have, bipolar disorder, that there's so many forms of mental illness that manifest itself in so many ways. And similarly for drugs, you know this from your time as a cop, that somebody on heroin, somebody on marijuana, somebody on fentanyl, somebody on cocaine, they all manifest themselves differently on those different types of drugs, and you have to approach them differently depending on what type of drug that they're on. It's amazing the cops get anything done, because it's just the challenges have expanded so dramatically in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
I'd like to get into some education and leadership topics. So Robert Peel said the police are the people and the people are the police. Most police officers, from my experience, are pretty conservative. And reading your book, you have some more liberal views on some issues. What responsibilities do cops on the beat and cops in management positions have to educate themselves about some of the ideas in their more liberal communities?
Challenge for police, and actually the requirement for police, and this goes back to Sir Robert Peel's 9 principles, you know, the people are the police and the police are the people. We don't import cops from Mars. We basically bring them up through the neighborhoods, by and large, usually working class. And so we are of the people. We are the people. And but we are given awesome powers and responsibilities. And with those powers and responsibilities comes the need to always understand that whether you're dealing with a white person, black person, poor person, emotionally disturbed person, that there is certain expectations of behavior that the public has of the police and that the police have to have of themselves, that we always have to police constitutionally within the law. We can't break the law to enforce it. And so many cops end up getting themselves jammed up when they step over that line. Secondly, they have to police consistently. By that, I mean, you cannot police differently in a black neighborhood from a white neighborhood, poor neighborhood from a rich neighborhood, in the sense of you can't be telling somebody you can't sit in the front your front stoop drinking a beer in a black neighborhood, and then in the white neighborhood, you ignore it. There needs to be consistency. And understandably, certain neighborhoods, unfortunately, oftentimes minority neighborhoods, there's so much more disorder. It requires so much more police interference. But even that interference, if you will, by the police in terms of interrupting behavior needs to be constitutional, needs to be consistent, and needs to be compassionate. The idea of the various levels of interaction that a police officer goes through. You can start with a verbal admonition, you move it up to a summons, a citation, you can potentially move it up to an arrest if necessary. But the idea that we've been trying over these last number of years is to, and it goes back to my training as a hostage negotiator back in the 70s, of de-escalation. The cop's most potent weapon and also his most dangerous weapon isn't his gun, it's his tongue. That in terms of how you use it, how you speak to people, how you control your language. And it's so difficult in moments of passion, fear, disorder to do that. And that's where the training is so important. And one of the great mistakes of defund the police was that we have never, throughout the history of policing, done enough training for our cops, either in the academy. Let's face it, 6 months is not enough. And in-service training is so inadequate in terms of training to get to the rest of their career that training, and defund the police was going to basically take away even what limited funds we had for that purpose. And that's why the idiocy of it, the lunacy of it, and why it is a failed philosophy and policy, and why many cities are now rejecting it out of hand. But no, there's no denying being a cop is a policeman's lot is not a happy one. But the reality is, if you're going to accept the responsibility, if you're going to take the oath, if you're going to wear the badge, it's with certain expectations of your behavior. And as a leader, a police leader, I'm always mindful of that, the idea when I'm sitting in on disciplinary hearings, in the sense of what were the actions of the officer? Were they constitutional? Were they compassionate? Were they consistent? Were they appropriate for the incident in which he took action? Being a policeman is a police officer, not a policeman, since police women are so prominent in the ranks, that nobody said it would be easy. And it's become more difficult the last couple of years, as you well know, in the sense of all the frustrations that really began or exploded around the George Floyd murder. But the good news is we will continue to attract some of the best and the brightest and the finest into the profession. May take us a while to get those recruit numbers back up again, but policing is always learning. The profession is always learning. And I can attest to the 50 years I've been in the profession. I'm always learning. I'm never going to get a diploma if I haven't completed my learning, because every day is a learning experience.
So true. In all your books, Turnaround, Collaborative Parish, and The Profession, you import leadership lessons. So as a stubborn Irishman, I particularly appreciated the lesson about accepting people's points of view and then moving forward to find some common ground and to collaborate. Could you just speak to that lesson?
Yeah, in terms of in the second book, Collaborate or Perish, it was a book that had about 24 Harvard-style case studies, including several Harvard case studies. And some of them were my own experiences. Others were experiences of other people who were facing great challenges. And out of that, working with my co-author on that book, we came up with 8 principles or elements of leadership. Every leadership management book has the 6, 8, 10 points of principles that you should follow. And in terms of my appreciation of being a leader, I've always wanted to be a leader. I think I am a leader. I think I'm a good leader. I think I'm a transformational leader in that the leadership challenges I accept are to transform organizations, hopefully make them better, or in the case of policing, for the public and for the cops themselves. But the first one is to have a vision. Where do you want to go? Where do you want to take this organization? Secondly, in a sense, do a CAT scan of the organization. In the case of my case, New York City, Boston, Los Angeles Police Department, do a CAT scan of the cities they're being asked to police. What are the issues? What are the concerns? And effectively hear everybody out. Is one of the books, my most recent in the profession, I talk about a community leader in South LA, Sweet Alice, who moved out of a sharecropper, horrific experience as a child in the deep South during Jim Crow days, like so many blacks, moved to Los Angeles to get away from it, and founded in the middle of Watts, in the middle of all those gang wars, et cetera, a community institution that's there trying to help people to get on with their lives. And I spent a lot of time with Sweet Alice. She's a wonderful woman now in her 80s. And as I was leaving LA, my last couple of days in the job there, went down to see her, say goodbye to her. We were hugging each other. And she looked at me and she said, "You know, Chief Bratton," and she had this delightful Southern accent. She never lost it. It's like me with my Boston accent. She says, "You know what? You know why we all like you so much?" And I said, "No, Sweet Alice, why is that?" She says, "Because you see us. You really see us." That's the best compliment I've ever had in my 50 years in policing. The idea that here's this black woman who felt that this white kid, Irish kid from Boston, Dorchester, who grew up in a segregated school system, worked through the desegregation of schools and housing in Boston in the 70s in my first 10 years in the job, that I could see in their eyes how they saw us, why they saw us in a certain way because of their experiences. And so the idea of common ground, the expression that you use, which I use in those 8 points, try to find common ground where everybody with different points of view can come together to have discourse. The Boston Common in Boston, the centerpiece of the city of Boston, was intended to be a place where people could come forward with their different ideas and express them. Marble Arch in London, the center of London, Sir Robert Peel's hometown. Marble Arch was the idea of anybody could go and stand on a box under that arch and express their opinions. And that leadership is about really trying to form your vision, form your goals, form your strategies, so that to the greatest degree possible, you meet the greatest number of people's demands and expectations possible. And I'm a great supporter of some of the terminology in Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, because when I read that book and got some exposure to him and some lectures I attended, it applied to what I was trying to do in policing. And let me close this set of comments with several terms. You talked about the bus. Get the right people on the bus. Get the wrong people off the bus. Get the right people in the right seats and start on your journey. And every department I've ever gone into, I've attempted to get people who believed in my vision and contributed to it and who had ideas of their own that could be encompassed. Got them on the bus, and then during that journey, they moved around to different seats, promoted up, et cetera. But everybody on that bus, I wanted to basically think that someday they could be driving the bus. And I didn't worry about that because I knew at some point in time I was going to get off the bus and feel comfortable that they were going to continue the journey. And there's another expression he talked about, the flywheel. The flywheel for your audience is it's a wheel with a handle, and it's very difficult to get it to start turning, very difficult. But the more hands you have on the handle, the quicker you can overcome the resistance and get that wheel spinning. And then the concept of the flywheel, once you get it spinning, it spins on its own. And that's what I try to do with leadership, to get as many people on the bus that share my vision, give them opportunity to move around on the bus and eventually get me off the bus and take over. But also the more people that embrace an idea, and this is what happened in the NYPD in the 90s. Cops like the idea that they're being asked to, for the first time in many of their careers, to be cops. Get out in the street, deal with the crime, deal with the disorder, but do it constitutionally, compassionately and consistently. And we did it, and we won. Crime down by 80%, murders down by 90%. The disorder was gone, the squeegee pests were gone, the illegal peddlers were gone. The 5,000 open-air drug markets on the corners and parks were gone. Fare evasion was gone in the subway. The prostitutes were gone. All the things that we now see once again in the city of New York were gone. Then they came back.
And they came back. It's tough to take.
Using an expression from the late, great John Timoney, who you know, former chief of department, John said that those who don't know the history are doomed to repeat it. Those who know the police know we don't know our history. Well, it's true. A lot of police don't know their histories, and a lot of politicians in this city, in this country right now, don't know their history in terms of what worked. They're trying to create new things. Sometimes it's take a look back and see what was working in the past and can it be modified. And I think you'd be surprised it could work again. My prediction is to get out of the mess we're in. We're going to have to go back to a lot of what we were doing in the 90s. And we have learned from some of the things we did back then that we don't want to repeat, that we don't want to do. But that's it. Always be learning. Always be learning.
Yes, and we've been fortunate to have some great police leaders on a national stage in this country, and you most preeminently. But recently we've seen some police departments who seem to be behind the times. The killing of Tyree Nichols in Memphis is one example, but there are some others. How does that happen in today's day and age? After all the lessons we've learned, you see some...
Case's point, speaking about Memphis, when you look at those five cops, all of them happen to be black, you look at them, most of them shouldn't have gone on the police department in the first place. It was part of the idea of lowering the standards, and that's something that's going on right now as we're having more difficult hiring cops. You don't want to lower standards. It's the last thing you want to do. Miami did that during the Mariel boat lift from Cuba in the 1980s and ended up with a mess of a department for 20 years after that. If you bring in trouble, you're going to have trouble. And my concern now, the lowering of standards and the hiring of people, and Memphis is a prime example of that, you're just basically going to create trouble farther down the line. Better to run short staff for a period of time, but don't lower the quality. Do you want to go to a doctor who graduated 2 years early out of med school because there was a shortage of doctors? I don't think so. You'd much prefer to wait your turn with a doctor who actually finished med school. Same with policing. That was the idiocy of the defund the police movement. Better paid cops. We need better trained cops. We need better supervised cops. And all of that requires resources. It requires funding, and it requires commitment. And if you lower the level of commitment, if you lower the standards, get what you pay for, basically, is the way it comes down.
Yeah, it's so true. A few bad cops can have a serious ripple effect throughout a department.
Exactly. Yeah, garbage in, garbage out. That's exactly what happens.
So, legitimacy and openness is a big part of policing, and I don't want to get into any political portion of this, but there's people calling for, getting rid of the FBI. And I think the FBI serves a critical purpose in our society, counterterrorism to a variety of crime, helping smaller departments. But there's still people calling for their dissolution. I think a lot of that comes from the fact that they are they're just not open. It's hard to get straight answers. They don't answer questions. You kind of don't know what's going on behind the curtain. Do you think the FBI needs an overhaul?
But this goes back to my point about the Republicans and Democrats both share the blame for what's going on in America at the moment, in the sense of a lot of the rhetoric that the rise of the right wing militants, domestic violence in terms of thinking of family issues, but the idea of some of the violence that was exhibited on January 6th, a lot of that is the Republican right-wing rhetoric. A lot of what's going on in terms of crime and disorder is the Democratic far-left rhetoric. So there's blame to go around for the disorder, the fear, the challenges to our Constitution. But even this idea of to do away with the FBI, to do away with the CIA, this idea that they've been weaponized, Let's get real. Did they make mistakes? Some of them. There's some rogue agents, certainly. But I'm sorry, those 17,000 FBI agents, the vast majority of them, are working hard to keep America safe. And, as much problem as I have with certain judges, vast majority of the judges are trying to do the right thing. Same thing with district attorneys, that there's some that I have no use for, others that I think are doing a great job. But ultimately, it comes down to voters. We live in a democracy, thank God. So it's a matter of trying to do a better job educating voters. And how do you do that? By transparency. And you've seen that with the NYPD, the efforts the department has made over the years. You go on the website, there's almost everything the department is doing is on that website, CompStat numbers, et cetera, disciplinary actions. No, we're in an interesting place that I'm ever the optimist that we're in a tough place at the moment, an interesting place, but we've been there before. When I came into policing in the 1970s, the profession, the country was in a mess, the anti-war movement, the assassinations, the race issues of the 70s. And homelessness was being created. And the narcotics problem was just really beginning to bloom, the gun problem. So all of this was in the embryonic birthing stage in the 70s. In the 80s, it blew up and blew up so bad that we had the 90s where we finally had the will of the voters to correct it. I think we're in the same path right now. We're in a embryonic birthing phase that is creating the violence, creating the racial tensions again, creating the political perilous. And if history repeats itself, the voters will eventually wake up and say, it's like that movie years ago, Network. And Peter Finch, I think his name was, hung his head out the window. I'm fed up and I'm not going to take it anymore. Well, the American public's going to have to reach a point at some point in time, like they did in the early 90s, where they're going to say, we're fed up and we're not going to take it anymore. We want to have good government. We want to have good police. We want to have good political leaders. And we want people who are united around trying to get on common ground. And the dysfunction in Congress right now is Congress is all about trying to find common ground. But now, basically, they're like World War One. They're in the trenches. Between them is no man's land that nobody wants to get into. That you can't have effective government like that.
They're not performing their constitutional duty down there to work together and create laws. It's a shame. As we're coming up on the end of our time, I just wanted to, again, thank you very much for joining us today. Commissioner Bratton, as he said, optimistic view going forward. And I think we need the people who are mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore to get out there and cast their vote and move things back in the right direction. Thank you very much, Commissioner. I appreciate your time. Take care. Thank you.